Check, check, 1, 2. Can you hear me through there, Tom? Mic check, headphones check. 1, 2, 3. My name is Ryan Simpson, and I am an alcoholic. All right, let me hear it.
Rather than promotion, we need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of...
Thank you. Hi, everyone. I'm Sarah. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sarah. We love you, Sarah. Lots and lots and lots.
How much?
Oh. I did it.
Woo, thank you. I love you guys. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. Thank you for the committee and everybody who worked so hard to put this together. Thank you, Ashley. Thank you. Everybody who's made me feel so welcome, you know, inviting me here. I have a million things my head tells me before I'm about to talk, and none of them are good, I promise you. And, I could stand here for an hour, and I will rip that pedestal out from underneath myself very quickly because I am not this, you know, picture-perfect AA. And when I get up in the morning, my first thought when I get here is that, you know, they're going to want a refund for their flight as soon as I'm done talking. I don't belong here. Nobody wants to talk to me. No one wants to hear what I have to say. I come in and everybody's so excited. Everybody's celebrating. Everybody's laughing. And I'm like, well, I came here to bring the mood down, so you're welcome. We were having this dinner conversation and I was informed, and I didn't know this, that the Saturday night speaker is supposed to be entertaining. Well, I hate to inform you, but I'm not that speaker. I have never been that speaker. What I try to do, though, is I try to tell the truth. I try to tell the truth about what goes on in my head, even at 12 years sober, the truth about my current alcoholism and what happened before and what things are really like today. Because I used to come into AA and I would hear these speakers get up and they would talk about, like, well, I got sober and I'm living in a state of bliss, and I would think I was doing something wrong. Because I would get up with this head in the morning that tells me that there's something different with me. I'm separate from you. I don't even belong in a fellowship of alcoholics who are just like me. There's something wrong with me. This alcoholic mind, this ego that has tried to separate me my entire life. It always wants to make me greater than, or it wants to make me less than, but it will never tell me I'm just okay and I'm just like you. And I've had a mind like this my entire life. And I can wake up on this default setting on any given day, but the beautiful thing I have in Alcoholics Anonymous and the beautiful gift that I've been given here through these 12 steps is an ability to quiet that mind through a program of subtraction where I'm able to reduce self and grow this power in my life where I can quiet this mind and it doesn't control me anymore and it doesn't drive every decision I make in my life. So I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I am grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. I could stand up here for hours and talk about the passion and love I have for this fellowship, for the 12 steps, for the big book, and for everything AA has brought to my life. And I promise you, that's not what I look like coming in these rooms. The first time I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, I hated every single one of you happy, joyous, and free people. Honestly, if I had just come in and seen this tonight, I'm like, absolutely not. No. You want to know why? Because you guys have something. You're so free. You're like, all of this garbage I come in, this shame I come into Alcoholics Anonymous with, it's this weight that covers me to a point where I cannot breathe. And I walk in here and I separate myself because you have something that is never going to be available to a garbage piece of shit like me. You have a freedom, you have a redemption, you have a forgiveness, you can jump on chairs, you can dance, you can sing, you can laugh, and I can't do that. That's never going to be me. It's never going to be available to someone like me, not after the things I've done, not after the people I've hurt, not after the damage I've caused. That's what I believed, so I hated you. I hated this program. And the other thing I couldn't stand is I come in here and the only solution you're offering me is a spiritual one. That's not what I was looking for. I want a solution that's anything other than spiritual in nature. I want a man to solve my problems. And I went through many trying to, you know, realizing that that does not work. Money, I thought that was going to be a good one. It didn't work. You know, I'd have to have some for that to be a thing, but... Usually someone else's money, but still doesn't solve the problem. No, but all these external solutions, I want it to be something outside of me. I don't want it to be God. I don't want it to be this thing. Because I had a conception of God from very early on. It wasn't my conception. It was a conception somebody else gave me. And I wasn't one of those people who didn't have a conception of God. I grew up in a house where we talked about God all the time. My father is a retired Presbyterian minister, so everything was God, God, God. We prayed around the food. We went to church on Sunday, Sunday school, like everything was God. But the message I heard, and I'm not saying this is the message that was being said. I have to be very clear. My perception of reality is often very skewed. But the message that I heard about this power was that it was transactional in nature, and that if I was a good little girl, I could earn this power's love, and if I was a bad little girl, I was going to be punished, and God was going to reject me. And the problem with that is I was convinced from the very young age that I was a bad little girl, that there was something wrong with me, that I was inherently evil, because I couldn't tell the truth. Because even as a little kid, I'm already driven by 100 forms of fear and self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity. I'm already driven by these things. I'm living in this prison of my skin, walking around, wanting to connect with the world, wanting to connect with you, wanting to feel this power. I've been a seeker my entire life. All I've ever wanted was connection, and I can't find it. I go to school and the kids don't want to talk to me and I don't feel connection with them. In my home, I don't feel connection with my siblings and my family. I just feel apart, and it's painful and it's uncomfortable. And I put on these masks because if you saw what was inside me, you would hate me too. You would hate me just like I hate me, and it's like it was a prison. And then I picked up alcohol. And for the first time in my life, everything was okay. None of those things mattered anymore. I didn't care what the kids at school thought about me anymore. I didn't care what my parents said about me. I didn't care about the bad things that happened to me or the people that hurt me. For the first time in my entire life, all that fear, all that self-delusion, all that pity, all of that goes away, and that connection is there. My first spiritual experience was the moment I picked up a drink. And in that moment, I made a decision. I don't know I'm making a decision like this, but I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the power of alcohol for the next 2 decades of my life. I don't know I'm making this decision, but it was the only thing that had ever worked for me. So why would I ever want to let go of that? Everything fits. Everything is okay. I can breathe. And in the beginning, it is fun. It's a party. It's a good time. I'd be lying if I said anything else, and I don't have any real consequences. And also in the beginning, if I need to, I can stop or moderate. You know, it says in our literature that many of us started out as moderate or hard drinkers. I don't know that I was ever moderate. I've never had one of anything in my entire life, and I think I might have skipped over to that hard part. I don't say that because I think I'm really tough. I say that because our literature is very clear in the definitions. It says a moderate drinker can stop if they need to with little trouble, and that's never been my story. First time I ever needed to stop or moderate in any way is when I got pregnant at the age of 19 with my daughter. And see, this is what separates me from the normal drinker, the normal person like my sisters, right? When they're pregnant, you know what they're doing? They're picking out nursery stuff and baby names and decorating and nesting and doing all that motherly stuff. For me, it's different. What I'm doing is I'm counting the days like I'm in prison, like checking off the days on a calendar. When can I get this kid out of me so I can again experience that sense of ease and comfort that comes with that first drink? That's all I can think about because I'm back in the prison of my skin again, and it sucks and it hurts and it's painful. And so as soon as I give birth to my daughter, I'm off to the races again and I can breathe again. And as time progresses, I don't know that I'm suffering from a fatal and progressive illness that over any significant period of time, I get worse, never better. I have no idea. I know that I drink abnormally, right? I know that I don't have one of anything. I know that I've been like that from the beginning. I still don't understand why my father can sit around and sip a nice glass of scotch and describe the flavor to you. Like, I don't know, give me Everclear. I'm going to hold my nose and I'm getting it down. Like, I don't care what it tastes like. That's never been my thing. I just want the effect produced. But as time passes, I'm crossing over these invisible lines. I don't know I'm crossing. At one point, I go from being, you know, where it goes from being that party and a good time to being this job. Like, I can't function without it. I can't, you know, go to work without it. It's a full-time job. I need it to function in this world. It becomes a necessity. And as more time passes, it goes from being this job and this necessity to being a nightmare that I cannot wake up from, and things start to get really dark. See, I was able to stop or moderate when I had my daughter, but when you fast forward 7 years later to the second marriage and second pregnancy, I didn't want to stop. I couldn't stop, and I didn't stop. And I drank the entire pregnancy. And I gave birth to a baby who was 3 months premature, and he was 2 pounds. And the first time I laid eyes on him, he's in a NICU, and he's in an incubator, and he's essentially on life support. And the entire pregnancy, I had no ability to connect with this baby, but when I saw him in that condition, and I saw him for the first time in that moment, all that love and connection that was missing when I was pregnant, I felt that in that moment. I loved my little boy as much as I was capable of loving any human being at that point in my life. The problem is, what comes with that love is this overwhelming sense of shame and guilt because I know that I did this to him, that he can't breathe because of me, he can't be held because of me, and that is my fault, and there is no denying that. And the only thing at this point in my life I know that will remove that level of shame and guilt is more alcohol, more and more alcohol. But here's the problem. As time has progressed, alcohol is not producing the same effect anymore. I'm not getting that sense of ease and comfort anymore. I need more, and I need more, and I need more. And our book says in many different places that we have these moral and philosophical convictions galore, and we can't live up to them even when we want to, or we could wish to be moral, we could wish to be philosophically comforted. We can will these things with all our might. The need of power's not there. Because I know, I knew even then, I'm not a sociopath. I want to be a good mother. I wanted to be a good sister, daughter, wife, friend. I want to be a good person. I had morals and values, but I had no power to live up to them. Because the kind of mother I was, listen, I would get arrested on the way to my daughter's like basketball practice and nobody would see me for 2 weeks. Or I, you know, would take my baby in the car to the worst neighborhoods in Philadelphia and I would leave him in the car and throw a blanket over his head to hop around the corner and grab a drink. I was the kind of mother who got arrested with her 8-month-old baby in the car. And this is where things started to take a really dark turn for me. I remember, I went to jail and I got bailed out. And that night, my husband had to come pick up his 8-month-old baby from the police station. So by the time I get home, he's furious. He has everything packed up. He's going to leave and he's going to take our son. And at this point, I've already lost custody of my first daughter. I've already lost that first marriage. And I see him packed up and I see him ready to leave and I panic and I'm terrified. I'm so terrified I'm going to lose another family. I'm going to lose this exterior life that I have built around me to try to protect me. See, this is another delusion I suffer from and can suffer from it today, that if the outside of my life looks a certain way, then I'll be just fine. I'll be just like you. Give me the husband and the kid and the white picket fence and I'll be okay. See, I get those things, but I can't keep those things. And he's packed up and he's going to leave and he's going to take our child. And I panic and I start begging and pleading and promising. And I tell this man, I will do anything. I promise you. I'll do anything. Please don't leave me and please don't take my son from me. And I swear, I know it sounds cliche, but if you had hooked me up to that lie detector test, I would have passed because I meant it. I meant everything. Up until the point he said to me, okay, I'll stay on one condition. You go to treatment today. You get sober today. And I looked at that man, and I looked at my little boy, and I knew he was going to walk out that door, and I still said no. I still said no. Because this is what my alcoholism will tell me, right? It tells me I'll figure it out tomorrow. I'll get them back tomorrow. But right now, I need a drink. In that moment, I need alcohol more than I need a roof over my head, more than I need my marriage, more than I need my baby, more than I need oxygen. I need alcohol. And he leaves, and they never came back. And I want to drink myself to death. You know, I want to kill myself, really, but I'm too much of a coward to do that. And I suffer horribly under this idea that I chose this, that I am this vile piece of garbage, this waste of a human being, and I don't deserve recovery. I don't deserve to even live anymore because I believe I chose alcohol over every single person I ever loved. And it wasn't until many years later when I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous completely broken and out of ideas when a woman in AA opened up that book with me and explained to me what it says, and there is a solution, that for reasons yet obscure, most alcoholics have lost the power of choice when it comes to a drink. And when I saw that in black and white, something started to happen within me. I started to get set free just a little bit, because in that moment I knew something I had never known before. I knew I wasn't this human garbage beyond saving and beyond forgiveness and beyond redemption. I knew I was an alcoholic, and alcohol had that much power over me. I was beyond human aid. That's what I knew in that moment. And I want to stand here tonight, and I would love to tell you that him walking out the door was enough to get me to get into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, but it was not. Losing custody of both my kids was not enough to get me to stop. The 11 felonies that I racked up in my drinking career was not enough to get me to stop. Losing every job, every relationship, every home, everything that ever mattered to me was never enough to get me to stop. And if you're sitting in here tonight and you've had none of these consequences, it doesn't matter. None of that makes me an alcoholic. The only reason I even talk about them is because I want to illustrate the power alcohol had over me, that there was no human power, no threat, no consequence great enough to ever separate me from my one true love. You could tell me I was going to get locked up, and I'd be like, all right, well, catch me when you can. I don't want to pay bills anyway, right? You could tell me you were going to take my kids away from me, and I'd be like, you know what, I didn't want them anyway. Like, I didn't want to be a mother. It's not that I didn't love them. I just didn't want to be responsible. I'm too selfish. Or they're better off without me anyway. Or you could tell me I was going to die, and I'd be like, when? Can we hurry it up? I was like, that's what I'm waiting for. Like, none of that stuff was enough to get me in here. And I would come in and out of the rooms after these, like, little breaks where, you know, I would get separated through various external circumstances, usually law enforcement, by the way. But, there's a lot of effective ways to separate me from alcohol, and that's one of them. And every single time I would do the same thing. I would, you know, what our book talks about. I would make a firm resolution and never a decision, over and over again. And I would sit in places like these treatment facilities or in a jail cell, and I would make, you know what I'm going to do when I get out? I'm going to get my kids back. I'm going to get a career. You know what? I'm going to be a drug and alcohol counselor. Just a full disclosure, I worked in the field for 2 weeks sober. God bless all of you who do that. chose a totally different profession. But these are the things, like, I think I know what I'm going to do when I get out. And every single time they open the door, every single time they open the gate, I get out and I drink again, and I have no idea why. I can't figure it out, and this just keeps going. And I come in and out of the rooms, and you welcomed me, and you loved me, just like you've been so loving tonight to every single person in this room tonight. And, what I love so much, you know, we read these traditions. I love these traditions. Full disclosure, I also only learned them initially to argue effectively at my home group. But God uses my defects of character for good, because now I love them. But you know what? You know which one I love the most is the only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. But an honest desire is what it says in the long form, but you know what I love even more than that is none of you ever judged whether I had that, because I did not. I didn't have an honest desire to stop drinking. What I had was an honest desire for consequences to stop happening. That's it. So if you're sitting in this room tonight and you're just here because you want the consequences to stop, welcome, you are home. It doesn't matter what condition you show up in here, we love you anyway. You belong here. And that's how I showed up. But then something happened to me on May 2nd of 2012 that I wasn't seeking, I wasn't looking for, I wasn't expecting. See, I had been on a run, and this run, you know, was shorter than any other one I'd ever had, and it was different because at the end of every other run, they were years long. I usually ended up with nothing. Backpack full of clothes, maybe, couch hopping, essentially homeless, but this was different. I had external stuff. I had a roof over my head, I had a job, I had a car, I had money in my pocket, and I wanted to die. And I remember that last night, getting on the highway, driving to go get a drink in the middle of the night. For the first time in my entire life, I have this overwhelming and overpowering desire to turn my car around and go home and stop lying to my children and lying to my family and hurting every single person that I love. But no matter how great the desire was, I couldn't turn that steering wheel around. I couldn't do it. So for the first time, I cried out to a power that I didn't believe in and I certainly didn't think cared about me. Now, I've prayed throughout my life, but God was sort of this Santa Claus idea. Like, hey, do my will for me. Like, get me out of jail. Can I get some bail money? Make the judge in a good mood. Those kind of prayers. And when God doesn't fulfill those wishes, I assume God doesn't exist and God doesn't care about me. But this was different. In that moment, I knew this thing had me. I knew powerlessness in that moment that I had never known before. And I cried out to this power, and my prayer was simply this: dear God, please fucking kill me or stop me. Pounding on the steering wheel, begging God, kill me or stop me, because I couldn't do it anymore. Our book talks about this jumping off point, and for me, that was it. And then 12 hours later, I have handcuffs on. Now, you know, I don't know how God shows up for you, but again, law enforcement is God's preferred method for me. But it is, it's so effective. You know, and again, I want to sit here tonight and tell you I have this amazing moment, this gift of desperation where I cry out and God intervenes. I'm like, wow. And that's not what happened. What happened is, you know, this alcoholic ego of mine that has this remarkable recuperative power rebuilt itself 48 hours later when I'm in a jail cell, realizing this isn't what I wanted. I wanted a detox or something. I didn't want the concrete floor and the consequences. So I pick up the phone and I try to call all these human powers I've been manipulating and try to ask for help, and they all hang up on me. And that's it. And, you know, what happened was I got locked up on this minor charge that I thought I would get a slap on the wrist for, but the judge had other ideas, and she said it's time for state prison. And for 18 months, what I have is empirical evidence that what I suffer from does not come in a bottle. It comes in this, in this mind, being driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity, because what I do for the 18 months that I'm incarcerated is I call home on a phone account my parents are paying for, and I tell them what they need to do for me. Right? Or I write really long apology letters home about how sorry I am, but maybe if you were better parents or siblings, I wouldn't be here. P.S. Send money. This is me. Like, this is how I show up with no chemical or spiritual solution in my life. And after 18 months of this, I get out with ideas of how I'm going to run my life after I've burned it into the ground 8 million times, which is pure insanity. And thank God every single one of my ideas, as soon as I got home, got ripped out from underneath me, and I'm left curled up in the fetal position on the floor of a recovery house bathroom crying out to this power that I don't believe in and I don't think cares about me all over again, because I don't know what's wrong with me. I haven't had a drink in 18 months and I want to die. And if this is sober, I don't want this. And I cried out, help me. And this power, I don't know, maybe it's just the human powers that I believe God works through, got me up the steps in my old home group where something started to happen. When I walked in that room this last time, or this first time, whatever you want to call it, and I walked, it was different. Those happy, joyous, and free people weren't strangers. They were my friends who I drank with. They were people who were living on the streets of Philadelphia who once had been homeless but were now in the rooms lit up like Christmas trees, talking about God and the 12 steps and carrying around that book and helping people. And I knew they didn't have the power to do that. I knew they were just like me. And I'm still not convinced at this point this is going to work for me, because my ego is still separating me. I'm still either way better than you or way worse than you. Usually, you know, at this time, way worse than you. And but I'm out of ideas, so I asked a woman to sponsor me and take me through these 12 steps, and she did, and nothing about it. I didn't have this heavens opening up, white light experience. My first third step experience was so awkward. You know, it was just like, I'm making probably the most important decision I've ever made in my entire life, to turn my will and my life over to this power. And I miss this moment because I'm too busy thinking about myself. These people are looking at us, holding hands. We're kneeling in front of other people. I don't even know the words I'm reading. But what I did do when I got up from that prayer is I started to write, just like she told me to. I started that inventory, because it says, if you turn that page over from our third step, although this decision is a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of what was blocking me. Blocking me from what? Blocking me from God and blocking me from you. And she tells me I get to write a list of all the people with whom I am angry, and I go to town. Here's 27 pages. You're going to listen to all of this, my horror story, my childhood, what happened to me. This is terrible. Because all I come in with is you and what you've done to me. I can't see past that second column. But while I sit with this woman in that fifth step and resolutely look at my mistakes and see this from a new angle, what happens is I start to see the truth. See, I didn't feel initially after my first fifth step experience that I could feel the nearness of my creator, you know, all those amazing promises. That was not my first experience. It was more, this is all, this is who I am. I was disgusted. I was saw in black and white who I really was. Like, for instance, my mother got a page to herself. Anybody else have a mom who made him an alcoholic? Yeah. Convinced. Here's what happened, right? when I was a teenager, these men did something terrible to me. My mother's reaction to it was, how could you be so stupid? How could you let this happen? From that moment on, it was my mission in life to make her life a living hell, to torture her, to drink at her, to hurt her. And as I get to that fourth column, where I'm looking at it from this different angle, where I look at how selfish and self-seeking and dishonest I've been, not only do I see what a monster I've been, but I see that I've taken this one decision my mother made when I'm a teenager, and I allow it to blind me to every beautiful thing she's ever done for me my entire life, the unconditional love she always showed me when she showed up in prisons and detoxes and when she invited me to family get-togethers when nobody else wanted me there. See, this is what my resentments do. They block me from the truth and they block me out of the sunlight of the spirit. And you know, when I'm first going into step 6 and 7, like I'm not holding on to anything. I'm not clinging to anything because I come in and the bar is so incredibly low. I'm breaking into people's homes, for God's sake. You know, I've never been faithful in my entire life. There's nothing I'm clinging to. Fast forward to 12 years sober, there's a lot of defects of character I love to cling to as long as there's a payoff on the other end. And I'm here to tell the truth tonight. Well, let me go argue on Twitter, that's a good time. Like, let me gossip at work, I love to judge. And like, as long as I'm experiencing some kind of payoff, it gets really difficult for me to get into that six-step practice of asking God for the willingness. But coming in, that's not my experience. I'm on my knees in step 7, and I'm like, you can have all of this. And I do that, and then I go out into the world, you know, attempting to sweep away the debris that had accumulated out of my efforts to live on self-will and run the show ourselves. I love the fact the book doesn't mention alcohol, because I don't need alcohol to burn my life to the ground and yours. I don't need alcohol to hurt you. And I go out and I start making these amends. Instead of saying I'm sorry, I tell people I'm wrong and I admit what I did and I try to make whole what I have broken. And that's when I started to experience what everybody in the rooms was talking about, this new freedom and a new happiness. I'm not going to regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. And by the time I get to that 12th step, when I'm sitting with another woman and I'm looking her in the eye and I'm hearing her story, I realize what this power, what these steps have done in my life. All of these vile, disgusting things that I thought I was going to take to my grave, that I thought I could never be redeemed for, never be forgiven for, they've been completely transformed, and they're my most useful tools in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. When a woman comes to me and she tells me, you know, I drank during my pregnancy, I abandoned my children, I cheated on my husband, I don't look at her in judgment. I can look at her in absolute love and say, me too. I understand. That was power, that was God, that was the connection I've been looking for my entire life. In all these outside places, I found it here. I found it in Alcoholics Anonymous. I found it through the 12 steps and through you. And I have this experience, and I start living this life beyond my wildest dreams, although coming in, I don't know what that means, because I think a life beyond my wildest dreams is supposed to be the cash and prizes of alcoholics. You know, what, I'm got the car, got the house, got the job. And listen, I got that stuff. Here's a fun fact, right? If you go to work and you don't embezzle money, or you actually show up and not nod out at your desk, people will hire you, okay? Like, if you walk through fear, you can go back to school. Like, I did stuff like that. Or when you pay your bills, instead of, like, throwing them out, you can get good credit. Like, I have a mortgage today. I have a career. I have that stuff. But that's not what I'm here to talk about tonight, because, like, that's probably stuff I should have been doing my entire life, and that's not what Alcoholics Anonymous really is, and that's not the life beyond my wildest dreams. And some of the gifts that I've received through this program and through these steps don't look like gifts on the surface, but they're the things that I hold most dear to my heart. They're my most precious gifts, like getting a phone call coming up on 4 years sober that my oldest sister was dead. And in that moment, intuitively knowing how to handle a situation that not only would have baffled me, that would have absolutely crippled me. Because in that moment, I knew this wasn't about me, that I had to show up and help my parents bury their daughter, and I had to help my sister's children bury their mother. And that's not like me. I'm given this beautiful gift, right, where I get to be with my mom and dad when they see their daughter in the casket for the first time, and I get to comfort my mom while she's doubled over in pain in the worst moment of her life, and I'm not running from this. This woman was my number one resentment, and I get to be there in this moment, present and okay, and with this guiding sense of peace within me. That's not me. On my power, I'm in the bathroom, I'm in a jail cell, I'm in a rehab, I'm making this all about me, creating family drama. It's just not me. And not only that, I had the last year and a half of my sister's life. We had the best friendship we had ever had. Not just sober, but like in our entire lives. We could never get along, but through the amends process, that relationship was not only made whole, but it was made beautiful. And she was my dearest friend at the time of her death. And I get to carry that with me for the rest of my life. And I get to show up in the lives of her daughter. I got to be there when her daughter gave birth to her first child. And a couple weeks ago, I got to be there when her other daughter got married. This is the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. And these are the things I'm holding dear to my heart. And I know when I was kind of running through these 12 steps, it sounds like I skipped over 10 and 11. Because you know what? For a lot of years sober, I did. I mean, I knew where they were in the book. And I'm not blaming a sponsor. I want to be very clear about that. I was given the information. I was given the instruction. I misunderstood it, I guess. I thought a 10-step was I call a buddy, and we vent about him or her or whatever. It was usually a gossip session where we got off. There was no God involved. I had a very rudimentary prayer life where it was like prayer in the morning, so a little bit of meditation here and there. And as time passes, I have this beautiful experience around my sister's death, but my life outside started to get really nice, and I slip into this thing called two-stepping, and if you're not familiar with what that is, it's, well, this is what it was like for me. I basically admit I'm powerless, and then I come to AA to save everybody else through my wonderful sponsorship. But I forget that there is an entire body of work that lies between 1 and 12, entire spiritual body of work, because I can't transmit something I haven't got. And then something happened. I don't know if anybody remembers, like, March of 2020, but there was an event, and all of a sudden the entire world shuts down, and like everything outside of me is stripped away, and I'm left with me and my sober skin, and not much of a solution left, and I'm suffering. And I experienced this beautiful moment of grace, and I know it's a moment of grace because a lot of people I love and respect had a similar moment and walked out that door and drank, and they're still trying to make their way back into these rooms. But in that moment, I knew that if I didn't take some action, I was going to drink again. Because I was absolutely insane. I was in an insane relationship. I was doing all sorts of hurtful things to people, stone cold sober. So I picked up the phone and I called this woman and I asked her for help. And she took me through the 12 steps from the very beginning, like I was a brand newcomer, like I knew absolutely nothing. And when I tell you it was the most freeing, beautiful, painful, humbling, sometimes even humiliating experience I've ever had. Like, I can't even really put into words how it changed my entire life. You know, it's one thing coming in and having an entire inventory of stuff you've basically done drunk, but it's another thing to have an entire inventory and an amends list that is 95% Alcoholics Anonymous. And that I have to go out and I have to walk through these amends and I have to make these appointments and sit with these people. Whew! But on the other side of that, I've never felt more free. And not only did I not, I've never felt more free, I fell in love with this program on a level that I had not experienced before, and no matter how painful or uncomfortable that experience was, I thank God for it every day. I'm so grateful I had that experience, because what it taught me was that I have to be practicing steps 10 and 11 in my life on a daily basis. That's my daily reprieve. That's my one day at a time. I was confused about what one day at a time meant coming in here. I thought it meant I come in and I hold on to my chair and hope to God I make it till midnight and maybe I can start it over tomorrow. I'm going to be honest. I'd put a fucking gun in my mouth if that's the way I had to live, right? That's, for me, is not going to work. My one day at a time is this daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition, and that meant I had to seek God on a different level, new books, new meditation, go further, seek to see where religious people were right. And not only, and then I really had to get into that 10-step practice where I continue to watch. Watch what? It says we continue to watch for selfishness, resentment, dishonesty, fear. What I'm really watching is my ego, my thinking mind, these crazy thoughts, the ones I opened up talking about, the ones that wake me up in the morning, tell me there's something wrong with me and something wrong with you, the thoughts that want to separate me. And as I start doing this practice of watching, something starts to change. I can watch and I can bring a power in and discussion, and I'm reacting to the world and I'm interacting with the world differently, and thank God. Because a year and a half ago, I remember I was on the phone with my little brother, and he's one of us, and we're having this stupid conversation. In fact, what we were doing is we were gossiping about my youngest brother's marriage. So I'm here to tell you these are perfect principles that I practice very imperfectly. Full disclosure yet again. But we're sitting there gossiping, and we both disagreed on how my brother should solve his marital problems, because we're both so successful at relationships. At one point, my brother got angry with me, and he said, well, why don't you just tell me how you really feel? And in that moment, that ego, that stage character, that Miss Alcoholics Anonymous pops right in. Okay, you asked, I'll tell you. And what I do in that moment is I say to my little brother in the calmest, kindest, most condescending way, like, I think it's time for you to start taking some accountability for your problems. And I think it's time for you to stop blaming mom and dad and talking down to him from this moral and spiritual hilltop. And he's not pleased. And he screams at me. He curses me out every different way and finally says, I'll never fucking speak to you again. And he hung up the phone and he immediately blocked my number. And the reason I bring up that 10th step and that watching is my first thought getting off that phone was, I'm right, he's wrong. I will get stuck here. But when I'm watching, I get off that call and I realize there's something underneath that. There's something going on. I don't feel right about that conversation. I know my brother's sick and I know he's suffering. And I don't want this division with my brother, so I have to do something. So I ask God to remove this feeling, this thought, this, you know, these ideas, and I call my sponsor. And we're on the phone for an hour, because this is how stubborn my ego can be when I'm trying to get to that, you know, different angle. But by the time we at the end of that conversation, we get to the truth, because that's what we're here to do. We're here to get to the truth. And the truth was this. I was absolutely terrified my baby brother was going to die. And I would have selfishly done or said anything to keep him here. Anything. So my sponsor tells me, you have to make an amends. That's our third part of our 10th step. You have to make this right. And I'm absolutely willing, but my brother blocked my number, so I don't know what to do. She said, text him for the next 3 days. If he doesn't unblock you, you write a letter, you put it in the mail, and you mail it. And I do exactly what she says. And after the third day, I called his girlfriend. I got the address, and I wrote the note. And I say note because I wouldn't give myself the full sheet of paper. You want to know why? Because if I did that, my ego creeps its way in there and will make all the excuses about why I'm sorry and all this garbage. And so instead, I wrote three sentences to my little brother. Dear Benjamin, I was wrong to speak to you that way. You didn't deserve it. I love you very much. And 2 months later, my brother died as a direct result of this disease. And on the morning of his death, I was on the phone with his girlfriend for 2 hours, because this is what we get to do here. We're taught to be, you know, we get to be of maximum service to God and the people around us. And I'm on the phone with her because she's suffering and she's in pain, and she was there when he died, and I'm trying to comfort her and console her. But in this conversation, she shares with me that my brother read that note, and she tells me how he responded, you know, which is the way he responded to everything. He was cocky, he was arrogant. He made a joke, something like, I'm going to make her sweat it out a little bit longer. But see, here's what the gift I got in this moment, the gift AA gave me, the gift these steps give me is, in that moment, I knew that up until my brother took his last breath, he knew that I loved him, and I know that he loved me, and I don't walk around with the guilt and the shame of that last conversation. Do I wish it had gone differently? Absolutely. Do I wish I could have told the truth to my brother in that moment, and the truth simply being, I love you and I'm scared for you? Yes. But I don't live with that shame and that weight, and I got to do the things that we get to do here. I got to carry his ashes to the funeral, and I got to give his eulogy, and I got to be there again for my parents who were suffering in their grief yet again. See, when I'm talking about this life beyond my wildest dreams, this is it. Being a part of this thing called life, the joy, the sorrow, the laughter, the celebration, everything we walked into, this is it. This is this light beyond my wildest dreams. I ran from everything. I numbed myself from everything. I came into AA and everybody would say nice things like, life shows up. Fun fact, life's been here. What the 12 steps have done have given me a design for living to help me be present in this thing called life and be okay in it. And I've never experienced anything like that before. That was the gift. And it is not all sorrow, believe me. There is so much joy. There is so much love. There is so much connection in my life today. These roles that God has assigned me that I get to play with such joy and such gratitude. like I get to be this daughter today, the daughter I always wanted to be to my parents. I get to be a mother to my daughter. I get to be a sponsor. I get to see women come in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous completely broken with nothing and watch their lives be transformed from the inside out, watch them regain their dignity, their respect, their children, their families, and watch them reach their hand out to the next one. And I get to experience that ripple effect that we get to see here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I get to be on the front lines and witness that every single day. And I love these women. They are my mirrors. They absolutely help me more than I help them. Absolutely. I don't know where I would be without these women. You know, I get to have these friendships and connections. And I'll tell you, like, this relationship with my daughter, I can't even tell you what a gift that is. My daughter has every single right to hate my guts after what I put her through. But she trusts me more than any other human being on this planet, including the man who raised her, her father. And not because he's not a good man. In fact, he's a very good friend of mine. You know, I celebrate holidays with him. I'm good friends with his new wife. I babysit their midlife crisis baby. And I adore her. We have this beautiful, amazing, healthy, blended family. And my daughter gets to experience that. That's AA. That's Alcoholics Anonymous right there. That's the ninth step. This is the power of what we can do here. But the reason she trusts me more than him is because you taught me how to be a mother. Before I came to AA, all I knew how to do was have babies. That's it. But you guys taught me how to love my child for who she is and how she is, not try to fix her or change her or make her somebody she's not, and she feels safe with me because of you. That's a gift. How could I ever repay that, even if I lived to be 200 years old? How could I repay that? That's the life beyond my wildest dreams. You know, and this life will never be perfect on the outside. No one's life will ever be perfect on the outside. The things I'm talking about here tonight, they're not unique to me. Every person in this room will experience loss and death and betrayal and pain and suffering, right? We're all going to experience these things. But with Alcoholics Anonymous and these 12 steps, we can walk through them. We're not promised anything material. We're not given any external promises. We're not given a promise that we're going to avoid pain and difficulty. We're promised that we're going to be given this spiritual kit of tools to navigate through life and walk through them with grace or even without, you know, maybe even a messy way, but we're going to get through them to the other side and we're going to be free and we're going to be okay. See, I have a son I haven't seen in 18 years now. You know, I used to say that I lost custody of him when he was 6 years old, but that's a lie. I abandoned my son. My son suffered a lot because of me. I was in and out of his life. I caused so much chaos and harm and confusion. In fact, I don't know that I will ever know the level of suffering that I caused that little boy. But I'm getting, you know, when I was getting sober, I'm taught to reach out and write letters and make these amends, and I write this letter to his father and stepmother, the woman who raised him, and they don't respond. And I follow it up, and they don't respond. They don't want to hear anything that I have to say. And at a few years sober, I start getting really angry about this. You know, there's this story in the book about a farmer coming up out of the cellar. I don't know if anybody's heard this part, but he's like, everything's destroyed from this tornado. And he comes up, and he's like, well, ain't it grand, the wind stopped blowing. That's me at a couple years sober. I'm like, I've ripped through this child's life and his, you know, parents' lives. It's a miracle he survived having me as a mother. And I don't say that dramatically. Like, I literally put him in harm's way. And I'm thinking a couple years sober is going to make that okay. You know? And so what I start doing is this thing that I don't know if you've ever done this, but I go around and I start asking a lot of opinions and advice. And I'm like going to choose which one is the best. Yeah. That's the one I like. And several people told me, you know what, get a lawyer. You didn't fully lose rights and all this other stuff. And I have this experience. See, this is how I know there's a power greater than me working in this universe, because I have this intuitive thought for the first time that maybe I don't get to do what I want to do, especially at the expense of my little boy. Maybe I don't get to do what I want to do. So instead of doing what I wanted to do, I did what the book suggests. It's like I asked God for an intuitive thought or decision. And I'm not great at the whole we relax and take it easy part. Just, you know, I'm a work in progress. But at this point, I hadn't seen him in 10 years. I didn't know what he looked like. And I'm angry. And I'm begging God. I'm scared. And I'm just asking, God, show me. Please show me something. I don't know what to do. Show me, show me. Weeks I go by, and then finally, one night I type my son's name into Instagram, and there he is. Beautiful and happy and loved. And I have this peace in my heart and this knowing that the restoration of my relationship with my boy will happen on God's time and not on mine. And the longer I stay sober and the more work that I do and the closer I get to this power, I have a deeper peace and understanding in my heart that that restoration may never look the way I want it to. God will use this relationship for something bigger. I just don't get to see what that is yet. And that's the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what we get here. You know, it says in our book that we have to burn the idea into the consciousness of every person that we can get well regardless of anyone. All we have to do is trust God and clean house. It's that simple. And it says, well, not sober, because when I'm well from the inside out, I don't need a drink to fix me anymore. I don't need anything to fix me anymore. These 12 steps produce the same effect as alcohol, even better, because I'm here for it and I'm present for it and I get to experience all of it. And I'm not special and I'm not unique. And I practice all of this imperfectly, but I get up one day at a time and try, and hopefully one day at a time for the rest of my life, I will continue to try imperfectly to practice these principles in all my affairs. And the beautiful thing about it, the gift I've received here, is it's available to every single one of us. All we have to do is work for it. I love you all. Thank you so much for having me tonight.